From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans are competing for the Democratic nomination to become, they hope, Georgia's first female governor. Across the state, women are also running for local office in record numbers. We'll hear from four of the candidates who want to make history. Also this hour, we'll look back at the legacy of President Jimmy Carter's administration. That's ahead. But first, on Friday, we talked in the break room about school bus drivers in DeKalb County who are demanding higher wages and improved benefits. In protest, hundreds of drivers did not go to work. A handful of them were fired. And here are your first thoughts. Dylan from Milledgeville tweets that Baldwin County, where he lives, has actually recently discussed increasing wages for school bus drivers, staff, and faculty. Dylan says, quote, if anyone is thinking about relocating to an area that appreciates people who contribute to the safety and well-being of students, come on down. Gotta say, Dylan, Milledgeville is a nice place to live. What's that taco place you got downtown? Gringo's? Love that place. Always want to hear from you, listeners. Do you think that school bus drivers who keep children safe on the ride to school need to be paid more? And also, what's your favorite taco place in the town where you live? Tell us what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Once upon a time, a species of parrot lived all over the South and the Midwest. Carolina parakeets had beautiful bright green feathers, and they were especially fond of the Georgia coast. Were fond, not are, sadly. The Carolina parakeet has been extinct for nearly a century, but knowing where they lived and how they died might help us to save other at-risk animals. That's at the heart of research done by Kevin Bergio. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Connecticut's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. His work with Carolina parakeets is featured in this month's Smithsonian Magazine. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
So if we had, if this was like one of those cheesy morning news shows on TV, where you were like the animal guy who came in with one of these things on your shoulder, and then I was going to awkwardly interact with it, and it was going to bite me, I'd be like, ah! What would this poor little parakeet look like?
Well, the parakeet has a yellow head, yellow and like an orangey red, actually, and the rest of its body is largely green, and they have some turquoise feathers in their wings. Mm-hmm. It's about the size of an American robin. It's a pretty common bird around here. Yeah, they're not huge. They're not like a macaw that you would see at the pet store.
Yeah. Do we know anything about what they sounded like?
No, not really. because, you know, nobody recorded anything back then before they went extinct. So there's, as far as I know, there's no voice recordings of them. But there's some descriptions of it, but they seem to sound like just a regular parrot screeching and making a lot of noise.
Right. So they were heavily concentrated on the Georgia coast. What was their extent? I mean, I'm a little more inland in Georgia. I'm in Macon. Would I have seen them around here?
It's quite possible. So the research that I published, they largely in their southeastern part of their range, which extended up to about D.C. And all the way to the coast around Texas. But they didn't really get inland too much. They were really quite fond of like swampy areas. And then river systems.
And how did the Carolina parakeet go extinct?
Well, that's a good question. And there's we still really don't know. Actively finishing up some research to look at that question directly. However, there's four major guesses of what people have thought over the years. One of them is, you know, because of trapping, or they were also considered a crop pest by some farmers. So they were shot because they like to eat apple seeds, not the apples themselves so much. So if you're an apple farmer, you know, in the 1700s, and you see a flock of birds eating all your apples, but not just the flesh, but just picking out the seeds and dropping the flesh on the ground, you might get pretty irritated, I guess.
Yeah.
And they were also caught as pets. In some places, people ate them. So that's one idea of why they went extinct. Another was that habitat loss, as you know, we converted a lot of our country to agriculture, especially in the 1800s. That's one potential way. And disease is another that people consider as a potential, but there's no real empirical evidence. There's no like we don't have a lot of observation of these birds being sick. And the last one was competition with bees, actually, for because these birds would nest in tree cavities and snags. And some people think that European honeybees would compete with them for these available cavities in these trees. But still, of those things, we don't know. It's likely maybe a combination of the first three I mentioned. I'm not so sold on the honeybee hypothesis, but.
All right. We're talking about the Carolina parakeet, a parakeet that existed across the South about 100 years ago until they went extinct, and especially concentrated on the Georgia coast. Kevin, you've called your work Lazarus Ecology. What does that mean? Are you going to bring these birds back, like Jurassic Park style?
Well, it was more the idea of naming it that was more of kind of the bringing back the ecology of a species that we'll likely never see again. Learning more about its biology, natural history through these kind of complicated statistical methods. So it wasn't so much about the birds. I don't do genetic work, so I'm not. I certainly wouldn't be the person who would do this kind of Jurassic Park thing to bring them back. There are people who do a lot of research on that. And from what I gather, the technology is rapidly getting to the point where it might be possible to do such a thing. But my research, the way that it bears on this, and that's that process is called de-extinction, at least among us ecologists.
I'm going to go with Jurassic Parking.
Okay, Jurassic Parking is fine with me. So if we were going to go about Jurassic Parking the species, you would need to know not only where it was, what kind of climate that it preferred, you'd also need to know if that where that climate might be going in the future. So presumably, if somebody went out to Jurassic Park this species, they would, presumably spend millions of dollars in kind of doing the genetic work and hand-raising all these individual birds and then doing the subsequent breeding. They would need to know where to release them eventually, right? You wouldn't want to spend all this money and time and just, like, let them go out the window and just see what happens. You'd probably want to put them in a position to succeed. Sure. So the research that I did was, like, trying to figure out what their climate niche was back in the 18 and early 1900s. And then you could use the model that I created to project in time as, you know, climates have changed since then and will continue to do so. You can actually project that model wherever you want to see where they'd likely succeed based at least on their climate, what they liked for their climate.
Sure. In the last minute that we have, Kevin, how can doing this kind of research about long extinct species, how can that help to help us preserve species that are still with us?
So at first you go into any scientific project, you know, with some vague ideas of how it may be applied generally. But you don't really know exactly until you find out what you find out, how it can be applied directly. So for this particular project, I set out, well, parrots are the most at-risk large group of birds in the world, where 43% of them are listed as near threatened or worse by the IUCN, which is an organization that kind of monitors the status of most species in the world. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the United States at the time where the populations of the Carolina parakeet were declining from, you know, starting in about 1800s and largely by 1900, they were just almost gone.
We got 30 seconds left, Kevin.
Oh, certainly. So what you could learn is if we could figure out how they went extinct and look at the places where parrots are most at risk today, usually in tropical areas in developing countries, if there is any kind of correlation between the things that we were doing at that time that affected the Carolina parakeet and those that are affecting parrots today, sure, we might be able to have some lessons from this extinction of this bird.
That's Kevin Bergio. Kevin, we're out of time. That's Kevin Bergio of the University of Connecticut's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. His research about the now extinct Carolina parakeet, which used to live on the Georgia coast, is in this month's Smithsonian Magazine. Spring saw Iranians celebrating their new year, called Nowruz. The Iranian community in Atlanta celebrated with vibrant music, delicious food, and dancing. This month, we sent On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxen to the Persian Festival at Piedmont Park. She brought back this audio postcard.
Once again, welcome to Atlanta Persian Festival.
My name is Behnaz C. Maliknia. I'm a president of Persian Cultural Center of Atlanta. This is our fifth year that we're having this festival at Piedmont Park. And every year it's growing. And after our Nowruz, which is it starts on the first day of spring, after 13 days, people and families come to a park, to a cool, grassy area far from home. They throw out the sprouts that they have grown for our Nowruz. They throw the sprouts in the water, and that way they complete the process of the end of 1 year and the rebirth of another. Persian food, our authentic food is kebab, beef kebab, chicken kebab with white rice with lots of saffron. We also have ice creams with saffron, and it seems that we use saffron in everything. It's the most expensive herb or spice in the world, and we just have to have it and use it.
What's your name and your last name?
Dorna Shakuhi. The clothing that you see here, or that we have presented here, are the traditional clothing of the Persian natives, and very colorful in terms of fabric patterns. You'll see paisley as a main pattern in the Persian traditional clothing. There are layers upon layers of skirts where it will allow for a nice, fluff around the ladies as they walk around. This clothing is still worn among the very rural areas of Iran where they are not bound by the political and the current religious clothing that women in the urban areas are forced to wear.
I'm here at the festival. I'm not Persian, but I want to learn about different culture, and I'm fascinated by the way people celebrate different traditions. So it's a really great event. I'm really glad to be here.
I'm in the festival because I'm Iranian and I know about this events, so it's we are celebrating the Sizdabedar now.
I'm from China. I come to the festival because I have a Persian friend and I want to have fun here.
I'm from Bangladesh. I came to the festival to support my friend who is Persian and enjoy with her.
I'm at the festival, and because I'm Persian and I want to introduce my culture to all of Americans, we love America. God bless America and God bless American.
That was produced by On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxen. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. It's a midterm election year, but this one finds women running for office in record numbers. Nationally, the number of women running for the U.S. House and Senate is almost double what it was in 2016. Here in Georgia, the trend holds. The Democratic nominee for governor will be a Stacey Abrams or Stacey Evans, whichever wins the primary. Many more women are also running for local offices. Why is this larger group of female candidates happening? My colleague Leah Fleming spoke with four women who have sought elected office in Georgia. Sarah Riggs Amico, running for lieutenant governor of Georgia, State Representative B. Wynn, and Mary Margaret Oliver, and State Senator Kay Kirkpatrick.
I want to first ask you ladies, what made you decide to run for office? Did you have any reservations in doing so? And I want to start, with Mary Margaret Oliver on the phone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I did not grow up in a political family and did not have much, if any, contact with politics. In fact, I had never walked into the state capitol until I was over 30 years old, even though my home is about 6 miles away. But I was assigned from my then employer, which was in my 20s, Georgia Legal Services to work on a project in relation to foreclosure notice to homeowners. And I walked into the Capitol and immediately became fascinated with this process that I, as just a legal services lawyer, could access and participate. Shortly thereafter, I went into private practice with my then Senator Pierre Howard and in Decatur, and have been in private practice since, and watched him closely as a lawyer and a state legislator do both jobs, and ran when the House seat became open.
What about you, Kay Kirkpatrick?
Yeah, I retired from my orthopedic surgery practice after 30 years of practice, and at that exact moment, my state senator resigned to run for Congress. And I started getting calls because I'd been involved in advocacy on behalf of doctors and patients for many years, and also had been a leader in my practice for many years. And I decided that I might have something to offer, and that's why I ran.
What about you, B?
When? Like Mary Margaret Oliver, I grew up in a household that wasn't very political. My parents are former refugees from Vietnam, and they led a country that didn't enable them to elect the people who represented them, and they did not teach us how to vote or become civically involved. And, you know, as an adult, I recognize the sense of disempowerment my parents had, and the fact that people who people don't represent people who look like my parents. And so I ended up working on a bill as an advocate called Pursuing Justice for Rape Victims, which cleared the backlog of rape kits. And at the Capitol, when I was talking to all these senators, everybody was a white man. And here we were talking about an issue that impacts women disproportionately as survivors. And many of the men had never talked to a survivor before. And that was the first time I felt like I belonged at a place like the Capitol. Mm.
Sarah Riggs-Amico, this is actually your first run for office. What made you decide to do that?
You know, it's funny. I run a company called Jack Cooper. We are the largest car haul company in North America. So the double-decker trucks that you see going down the highway full of cars, that's what we do. We made an unusual choice several years ago to fully fund health insurance premiums for every one of our employees. As costs were skyrocketing, most employers asked that their employees contribute more. And effectively, if you're not giving them a raise to cover that, then you're giving them a pay cut. So we decided to go the opposite direction. Last year, we introduced paid parental leave for our employees. We've experimented with on-site daycare. And so at a certain point, these issues sort of came into the boardroom for me. And so looking at the metrics, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, if I don't run, how do I know that somebody who wants the same level of accountability and that has the same track record of delivering results will take this job and will be able to go out and be a real voice for working families? And for me, it's appalling to me to watch people who've been in office for decades who have yet to deliver for the people of Georgia. So for me, it was a little bit of a moment to just say enough.
Well, speaking of saying enough, a lot of women are doing that. According to the Center for American Women in Politics, which is located at Rutgers University, at least 79 women are exploring runs for governor in 2018. That potentially doubles a record for female candidates, which was set back in 1994. Now, there are two women that are running for Georgia governor, by the way, Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans. And I want to ask you, what do you think is behind this cultural shift in large numbers of women that are running for office? Is it the Me Too movement, the pink wave, as it's been called, after this historic women's march, after the election of Donald Trump? Is it something else? What do you think is behind that? Mary Margaret Oliver, what do you think?
Obviously, it's all of the above. I think the shock that I personally felt at Donald Trump defeating Hillary Clinton was felt by countless other women, particularly women. I think that even though I've been in politics a long time, it still was a very big shock to me that every indication about our polling data and our conventional wisdom of those who said they knew was totally wrong. President Trump's comments that we don't need to review all that about women are, and as they are in the news today, pretty horrific. And I think that people have responded, women have responded, on an emotional, personal level that enough's enough. I believe Emily's list has gone from 700 candidates interested in women candidates interested in politics to 15,000.
Yeah, especially in these national races, we're hearing stories about women being coached on how to perhaps appear less feminine. So maybe not so much about bringing the baby onto the floor, but we're hearing about that. And I'm wondering, with you, Sarah, as you are running for office, have you had any training like that? Has anybody kind of whispered in your ear that you need to think about this?
Not more than once. You know, look, I've spent most of the last 15 years, I'm about to go to my 15-year reunion for business school. And most of the last 15 years, I've been the only woman on a management team and certainly the only woman on a boardroom. In fact, when I was made chairman at Jack Cooper, the first thing I did was add another woman. It happened to be African-American, but I added her because she's phenomenal. Her skill sets were incredible. And it was amazing to me how much more robust and thoughtful and multifaceted our discussions became. And because of that, the governance of the business became much better. And I think the same thing will happen when the halls of power, whether that's under the Gold Dome or in the corporate boardrooms, look more like the communities where we live and work. And so for me, I'm used to being the only girl around. But I think we need to teach women to play to their strengths, whatever they are. And I don't believe that's monolithic by gender. I think that's unique to the individual. Women do have an incredible capacity for empathy. And I think right now empathy is something we could see a lot more of in our government, in the way we make policies. You know, this is the first time in my life that I can ever remember our politicians spending more time telling us why we should be afraid of our neighbors or of other instead of telling us what unites us as Americans. So for me, no, I haven't been coached. I mean, we did the focus groups at the beginning of deciding to run as part of our polling, and it was an experience. You know, for a first-time candidate, I married a man who was not born an American. He chose to be an American and became a citizen actually at Turner Field over a July 4th weekend some years ago. And a pretty emotional ceremony watching him and people from 100 countries around the world take the oath of citizenship. And so one of the pieces of feedback that we got was that my last name sounded foreign, Amico. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know what to tell you. It is, you know, but I don't think that makes me less American or less capable. If anything, I think it makes my family quintessentially American. Like B, our family mixes languages, foods, culture. We pile children on, you know, transcontinental flights to visit grandparents. It's, I'm proud to be a part of that story. So no, nobody's tried to coach me, and they certainly wouldn't make much traction.
Yeah. If you're joining me, I'm speaking with Sarah Riggs Amico, B. Wen, Kay Kirkpatrick, and Mary Margaret Oliver. And Mary, Margaret, I want to ask you a question. Political scientists in general say that an influx of women candidates does not necessarily mean that more women will be inspired to vote for those candidates. And I'm wondering, what do you make of that?
The political science around gender gap is a pretty hot topic right now, and we know, looking at the recent elections over the last several election cycles, that the gender gap has been stronger some years than others. I think women are realizing that the variety of women going into politics now is a huge strength for them. There are more different characters of types, kinds, roles of women that are in politics. Now, when I first came into the Capitol as a very young do-gooder lobbyist, every single woman elected was older, married, had been a stay-at-home traditional volunteer for a good while. Not one worked outside the home. During my political life, that has totally changed, to where women represent every aspect of our working and family roles. It is still true, though, I think, that women are carrying more of the family role as they leave their home for work, whether it's work at the Capitol or work at my law office or work at Sarah's business.
Mm. What do you think, Kay?
Well, I would have to say that it hasn't been true. In my marriage, my husband worked part-time because he could, and I worked very full-time because I could. And we shared the responsibilities, but I would say it's been pretty much of an equal split.
An equal split for you all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, B, what advice do you have for other women that are perhaps considering a run for office?
Just do it. Statistics show us that it takes women 5 to 7 times of somebody asking them to run on average before they decide to run. And that's not true for a man. I was in that same spot. I did not decide to run initially. I had to be asked to run very persistently, by, in particular, by one young woman who became my campaign manager. The reasons I didn't want to run were, why should I run if there's somebody else already running, somebody else who is qualified, somebody else who would do a good job? And so it took me, you know, moments, many moments, to make that decision to put myself out there. And the questions I had were also, am I prepared for this? Which I was, in many ways, and which I was not in many ways. But I think that's true of anybody who decides to run for office. It is a huge learning curve. And the things that you think you would do, the things that you think you are, change when you're in that particular environment. And everything that you believed, you know, was going to happen may not necessarily happen when you get in that space. And it's perfectly fine. I think that is one thing that we don't talk enough about as elected officials, is the reality of what it actually means and what it's actually like once you get in those chambers. It's very different than what it's like to be a candidate running for office. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that anyone could ever be qualified enough to understand what that exactly means.
You found that to be the true, Kay?
I 100% agree with the steep learning curve of being a candidate, but also of being in your first session in the legislature. There is a sort of a handbook, but it's not, it doesn't tell you anything really about how things actually work down there. And obviously, as one of the two female Republicans in the Senate, I have a little bit different experience probably than B had, but I found the men to be very welcoming. And that's not always the case with all the women. So I got along just fine with everybody, but I really was disappointed in the difference between my other job, where I could actually get things done without a whole lot of trouble by getting the right people in the room, asking the right questions, and so on, versus the legislature, where it's very hard to make things happen. And maybe our founding fathers planned it that way so that we wouldn't do too much. And that's why we have three branches of government. But yes, I think the learning curve is very, very steep.
Yeah. Yeah. What advice do you have, Mary Margaret?
I've worked in three different cultures, work cultures, a traditional law practice litigation culture, and an academic culture I've taught for a good many years in law schools, and then the political culture. The political culture is totally different. I think it's attractive to me, still attractive to me, because it is so diverse and so freewheeling. But in the political culture, there's really not a rule book. There's very seldom somebody really in charge. The sanctions for bad behavior are fleeting and non-existent. Whereas in my law practice, simply a more rational place to do work, and it's a more intellectually honest place to do work. The shock of politics to me is not so much not being able to get things done, which I certainly understand and sympathize with, but there's such a dramatic difference of opinion and fundamentally different approaches to government that I kind of expect that. What I still can't get over in the political arena is what I consider just simply bad behavior that's not acceptable in a traditional work environment.
What about you, Sarah? What advice do you have? Are you excited, first of all, to see more women running for office?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have 2 daughters, 5 and 7 years old, and I think having all of these women, and candidly on both sides of the aisle, running for office will mean that when they grow up, this doesn't seem like an odd thing to do for them. So I think it's important that government starts to reflect the communities where we're representing the people. My advice would be similar to Bee's: do it. There's no disadvantage to participating. I think, you know, the enemy of democracy is not a political party. It's not a political figure or candidate. It's apathy. It's the lack of engagement on the part of everyday citizens to believe that they can make a difference, whether that's with their one vote or whether that's with the opportunity to run for office.
That was Sarah Riggs Amico, who is running for Lieutenant Governor of Georgia. You've also heard from State Representatives Bee Wynn and Mary Margaret Oliver, and we heard from State Senator Kay Kirkpatrick with us. Thank you to all of you ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
That was GPB's Leah Fleming, and we'd like to hear from you. Are you a woman running for office for the first time? Tell us why. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Nationwide, communities are examining the role of syringe exchange programs. This is in response to the opioid epidemic. One Georgia pastor in Cherokee County plans to move forward with a needle exchange program at his church, but not everyone is on board. We'll learn more about how needle exchange programs work on tomorrow's show, but we'd like first to hear from you. What do you think should be done to solve the opioid crisis? Give us a call. Leave a message, 404-500-9457. And you can find us on Twitter or Facebook, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Georgia native Jimmy Carter was the 39th president of the United States. Of course, he served from 1977 to 1981. Halfway through his presidency, he gave his crisis of confidence speech.
I promise you a president who is not isolated from the people, who feels your pain and who shares your dreams and who draws his strength and his wisdom from you.
Stuart Eisenstadt was Carter's chief domestic policy advisor, and he has a new book out about the Carter administration. It's called President Carter, The White House Years. He joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Stuart.
Adam, good morning. Thank you.
President Carter famously brought a lot of people in his administration with him from Georgia. Were you one of those?
Yes, I had been his policy director when he ran for governor. I was his policy director when he ran for president. And I was his White House domestic policy advisor for 4 years in the White House, but also involved in a number of foreign policy matters as well.
Now, a lot of your colleagues from those years have written books about Carter. Historians have written innumerable books. The Carter administration is half a century old at this point. What did you feel that you had that was new to contribute?
Well, thank you, Adam. First, there is not a comprehensive biography of the Carter administration at all. And I felt that I needed to do that. Second, I had a unique view. I took over 5,000 pages of contemporaneous notes of every meeting and phone call, what all the key actors were doing. I've interviewed over 350 people, positive and negative, to write a comprehensive review. I've looked at every conceivable classified, now declassified documents. And the basic reason was I felt that the problems he had, which of course resulted in a landslide loss in 1980, and which I do not, underscore, do not whitewash, totally have obscured a remarkable and accomplished presidency. Indeed, I would assert, and I believe my book will verify, that he was the most accomplished one-term president that we've had in modern times, and indeed accomplished more than almost any other two-term president. Congress passed, for example, 70% of his legislative proposals, only slightly less than the legislative master, Lyndon Johnson. So I wanted to do something special about the president. His political idol was Harry Truman. He placed Truman's favorite slogan on his desk, "The buck stops here," and both left as widely unpopular presidents. Truman is now recognized more for his achievements than his faults, Adam, and I hope my book will contribute to a similar reassessment of Jimmy Carter as president, not just as our most admired former president.
What would you say is his greatest single achievement from his presidency?
Well, there are so many that it's hard to pick one, but let me try to pick one in the domestic area and one in the foreign policy area, but I hope I'll have a chance during this segment to go into more detail. I think domestically his most important accomplishment was providing the foundation for the energy security we enjoy today. He did that by decontrolling, and this is over three bills in 4 years, decontrolling the price of natural gas and crude oil to encourage their maximum production. He put conservation at the center of our agenda for the country. And he inaugurated the new era of clean energy with solar and wind power by tax credits and other incentives, and even putting a solar panel on the White House. On foreign policy, It's a close call between the Camp David Accords, which are historic, led to the Egypt-Israel Treaty, the first between Israel and its Arab enemies. That's lasted, Adam, for now 40 years without any infraction at all. Relations now between Israel and Egypt against Iran and terrorism are very deep. But human rights, putting human rights as a central part of his foreign policy, applying it to Latin American dictators, cutting off their arms, reaching out to the dissident movement, and together with the Panama Canal Treaty, creating a new era in relations, and also applying it, Adam, to the Soviet Union, reaching out to democratic dissidents, and to the Soviet jury movement, saving Sharansky's life during the trial, the head of the Soviet Jewish movement. These are just a few of the highlights. So I would say energy, Camp David, and human rights. But again, there is so much more to discuss.
We're talking about President Jimmy Carter's legacy with Stuart Eisenstadt. He's the author of a new book, President Carter, The White House Years. Stuart Eisenstadt is one of the many people that President Carter brought to the White House with him from his gubernatorial administration in Georgia. We were talking about the greatest hits. Let's talk about some of the greatest misses. I suppose that a lot of people regard the Iranian revolution and ensuing American hostage crisis to be one of the things that kept President Carter from winning a second term. You have a new perspective in your book about the aborted rescue mission to free those 50-some American hostages that were being held at the embassy by the Iranian revolutionaries.
Yes, and as I said, Adam, the book is candid and it's balanced. I believe the lethal combination of Ted Kennedy's divisive challenge to his Democratic renomination and Iran in two respects helped lead to the overwhelming defeat. And I say two respects because the Iranian Revolution produced two things. One, huge crude oil shortages, which led inflation to go into the stratosphere, into double digits. It happened with Nixon and it happened with us. And, of course, the Iranian hostage crisis and the rescue mission. Now, you asked specifically about the rescue mission. Mm-hmm. The rescue mission, I think, had a very, very slight chance of succeeding to begin with. It was exceedingly complicated. It required a number of actions in the Iranian desert and going into Tehran, which were themselves very difficult. But the basic reason was not the simplistic notion, well, if we just had another helicopter, backup helicopter. The president actually added another helicopter to that which the military required. Rather, it was, interestingly, the lack of practice. And I give, having grown up in Atlanta and in Georgia, sort of an example that when somebody like Wally Butts, Georgia, or Bear Bryant, the coach of Alabama, they practiced with all the elements of their team always together. There was no practice between all the military services involved here, Marines, Air Force, Army, Navy. They had never worked together on a mission like this. We created a joint command later because of this. So there was no practice together. They were afraid that if they practiced together in, say, the California desert, the press would find out about it. And it was the absence of coordination of the four military services which led to the catastrophe, plus the fact that the Navy was so uncooperative that they did not want to put a carrier close by. And therefore, the helicopters, which were not the right attack helicopters, had to leave from a destination much further away in the Indian Ocean. And by the time they got to Desert One, had themselves had problems. If they had been in the Persian Gulf and closer, it would have had a greater chance of success. But really, at bottom, Adam, it was the lack of coordinated practice between the military services who had not previously coordinated on any kind of an activity and intervention like this.
You mentioned there that you grew up in Atlanta, Stuart. President Carter, of course, famously the peanut farmer from South Georgia. If you look at it, we've not had a lot of modern presidents from the South, especially if you take out Texas, which a lot of people would say you should. Maybe Bill Clinton's presidency sort of normalized Southernness in the White House in the modern era. But take us back to the time when you and your colleagues got to the White House. Was there a culture shock?
Yes. I mean, Jimmy Carter, remember, was the first Deep South president elected since Reconstruction. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, and I served in his White House, on his White House staff came from Texas. So Jimmy Carter was really the first Deep South candidate. He won all the southern states except Virginia. And he did things that really were not typical of southern candidates. For example, he appointed more women and African Americans to judgeships and senior administration posts than all the 38 presidents preceding him put together. He was a great consumer champion. He transformed our overregulated transportation system by deregulating trucks and railroads and bringing air travel to the middle class. There wouldn't be, I think, Adam, a Southwest and a JetBlue or UPS and FedEx air cargo as we know them today. Without that, he started the telecommunications revolution with deregulation and cable. He was also, and again, you wouldn't expect this necessarily from a Southern president, he was the greatest environmental president we've ever had since Theodore Roosevelt. He doubled the size of the national park system with Alaska lands. He brought ethics and good government. In fact, the reason in many ways we won the election in 76 was a combination of sort of Southern pride, which is why we swept so many Southern states, but it was also the post-Watergate era. He promised and delivered on ethics reforms. The 1978 Ethics Act, for example, required disclosures of assets going in and out, gift limits, limiting the so-called revolving door going out, created inspectors general to root out fraud and waste and abuse in every agency. And there's not a week that goes by, Adam, that you don't hear of an inspector general's report. He created the independent counsel to investigate wrongdoing by senior officials. And if that sounds current, it should. Sure. Merit selection of judges and so forth. And he created the modern vice presidency with Mondale. He took a position that was held in disrepute and brought him into the West Wing right near the Oval Office. So all of these things were really crucial and not recognized. And even his defense buildup to match the Soviet buildup, his normalization of relations with China, these were things that have simply gotten ignored because of the twin problems of inflation.
It goes on and on, Stuart, right. And unfortunately we have to leave it there. But fortunately you've written a book called President Carter, The White House Years, by Stuart Eisenstadt, a former Carter administration official himself who came from Atlanta. He served as President Carter's chief domestic policy advisor. Thank you so much, Stuart.
Adam, thank you for having me.
Today is International Jazz Day, and we salute it with an Atlanta jazz great. Virginia Shank is known by her stage name, VA. Tonight, she celebrates today's global celebration of jazz music with an Atlanta performance. We asked her to add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we asked people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are simple. All tunes must be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists cannot pick their own work. Virginia started off her picks for the Georgia playlist with the song I'm an Old Cowhand, written by Johnny Mercer.
I'm an old cowhand from the Rio Grande.
I chose that song because I remember my brother singing it to me when I was a child. I'm the youngest of four kids. And it's so in my bones that even before I really knew what jazz was, I realized it was already in my soma.
And I learned to ride, 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 for I learned to stand. I'm a riding fool who is up to date. I know every trail in the Lone Star State, because I ride the range in the Ford V8. Oh, yippee-yi-yo-ki-yay.
The song is about a Texan, which is very funny for a Georgian to be writing about a Texan. But riding on the range, and it paints a beautiful picture of that Texas landscape. And so for a lyricist to be able to create that scenario for us in our heads just is amazing to me.
We're old cowhands from the Rio Grande, and we come to town just to hear the band. We know all the songs that the cowboys know about the big corral where the dogies go. We learned them all on the radio. Yippee-yi-yo.
The second favorite song and artist, the artist would be the Allman Brothers.
Crossroads,
chose Melissa because it's just an amazing ballad. I have personal connection with the band. I happened to live in Macon, Georgia for a short spell and became friends with the jazz drummer J-Mo, and who's one of the only living now founding members of the Allman Brothers. And I was actually downtown Macon sitting in with for a jazz jam, and apparently he was on drums. And I thought, well, can he play jazz drums, you know? And, well, sure enough, he did. And we struck up conversation and became fast friends. And actually, he turned me on to so many jazz musicians. The sweet Melissa. And we can credit J-Mo for bringing his jazz background from the state of Mississippi over to Georgia, and he really was the one who instigated the jazz influence in the jam bands. So there we go back to talking about jazz and its influence in current day music.
That's Atlanta-based jazz artist Virginia Schenck with her picks for our Georgia playlist. She performs tonight in Atlanta as part of International Jazz Day. Her stage name, by the way, is VA. Details are at gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we'd like to hear from you as always. Who's your favorite Georgia singer? Who would you add to the Georgia playlist? Give us a call, 404-500-9457, or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk. Show's produced by Maura Curry, Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. John Powers is the senior producer. Don Smith edits the show, and Tanya Ott is the executive producer. Engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to the interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusa. Have a great one.